evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mona Montgomery with this evening's edition of The Hola Hoax. There were no gas chambers in Germany. There were no Jew skin lampshades. And there wasn't any pure Jew fat soap either. That's all propaganda slated against the white race to cripple us in our Achilles heel, which is our conscience. We've been convinced that we are the evilest of all races, when in fact we're completely innocent of all charges. Tonight, I'm going to try to reveal to you what I know about the Masons, and we might have a good opportunity for some debate. If you'd like to call me, the telephone number is area code 201-484-7809. My father was a 32 degree Mason. That's as high as you can get without being somebody like a president. And both of my grandfathers were also 32 degree Masons, and I was brought up in the home of Masons, and I'm here to tell you, they're very nice people. People scoff at the fact that every president has been a 33-degree Mason, which proves that you have to be a Mason in order to become a president. But that's not true. The Masons make honorary 33-degree Masons out of everyone who achieves the position of president. And I'm very upset by the fact that we, the white race, and our hierarchies, including our monarchies in Europe, and our upper class here in the United States, which is made up largely of Masons, is getting a bad deal from the propagandists who are trying to blame us for what the Jews have done to us. The Jews are not Masons in the essential sense of the word. Masons are, after all, builders, builders of buildings, builders of walls. That's why they call themselves Masons. And the reason they became so successful is because these white men decided that they could establish for themselves the standards of their profession instead of having to have the king teach them what was the right way to build a wall. So they got together and they decided that if they could build a better product than the king could, then he would trust them enough to let them rule their own trade. And that's exactly what they did. One of the things they did among themselves was to guarantee to each other that if any Mason got in trouble, the other Masons as a group would come to his assistance. And to this day, as much as you can say that Masons even exist anymore to this day, they still adhere to that principle. But you see, today they aren't Masons anymore because they've been infiltrated by blacks, browns, and Jews. And I saw this happen myself in the 60s. Dad would come home and say, "I'm afraid we're going to have to let Jews in." And it's not what we want, because the Masons were made up of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. You've heard the term WASPs, of course, W-A-S-P. That stands for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. They didn't even take Catholics. They liked themselves because of their intellectual prowess, and they looked down on anyone who believed in any kind of medieval superstition, like believing, well, everything that everybody believes except white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, who only believe, at least in the 60s before our church was taken over, we just believe that everything's right with the world and God's in his heaven and everything's okay. And as long as you are white and stay with white people and dress nicely and behave well, you don't have anything to worry about. Of course you're going to heaven. There wasn't all of this nonsense about getting down on your knees and confessing thrice to Christ that upon pain of death you would believe this, that, and the other. It just didn't exist. Not at least in the church I was brought up in. We just went to church because it was part of our lifestyle. And my father was a Mason because it was part of his lifestyle. And then this horrible thing happened in our churches and in the Masons. We started getting infiltrated. And that is what we have today. We have these Jews, which we felt so sorry for the Jews because, well, after all, they weren't very attractive, were they? And so we had to be kind of sorry for them. And they built up their own little B'nai B'rith and their own little Masonic lodge, and we didn't understand, the white people didn't understand what a terrible threat this was, because they thought, oh, well, you know, let the Jews do what Jews want to do as long as they don't come into our group. But today, the Masons apparently have been completely taken over by the Rothschilds, and there is no more power structure made of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, who were the founding fathers of this country, with the exception of my noble ancestor, Charles Carroll of Carrollton, who is a signator on the Declaration of Independence, and he was a Catholic. And he was the reason that Catholics are allowed to own property today, is because he argued with the Protestants that even Catholics should be allowed to own property as long as they adhered to the principles of the state and didn't let their religion get in the way. The Catholic religion has often been criticized for putting their belief system above the normal run-of-the-mill belief systems of people trying to conduct a civilization, like, well, normal stuff. So my ancestor gave all of the land to the United States, upon which now sits the Washington, D.C. And if you look at his statues, he looks exactly like my father. That's how strong this line is. This is how strong the genetic line is, a wonderful genetic line. I'm not a best example of it, but I do come from a wonderful genetic line. And he preached, and he tried to get, and he did get, the Anglo-Saxon Protestants to accept their Catholic brethren as almost equals. So that's how that came about. And he was a Mason, because he was a good Catholic man. How could he have been a Mason? That doesn't make sense. I'll have to look into my family history on that, because they didn't allow Catholics in the Masons at that time. Anyway, my father's name is not Carroll. It's Montgomery. Maybe the Montgomery line coming from England were the Masons. So now I've told you what Masons are, and we're about to discuss the Solomon's Temple, and I'm about to reveal to you why it is that the Masons so desperately want to rebuild Solomon's Temple, so that you'll understand some of the propaganda that you're getting about the Masons. But before I do, I wanted to introduce this with a little bit of history, because I know that many of the people that listen to this program believe that the Bible is the written word of God, and that if it says that time started 5,000 years ago, well, I guess that's when time started. But in fact, we have examples of Masons in Soviet Armenia that go back 45,000 years ago, with 200 furnaces. And you can see a picture of them on my website, which is nukeisraelnow.com. If you go into the enter, you'll see the remnants of these furnaces. So they had actual massive production in prehistoric time, before they could even read or write. Our ancestors were Masons, and they were producing vases and knives and spearheads and rings and bracelets. And undoubtedly, we know from the history of the pyramids that those pyramids were built, I think, 10,000 years ago by white people, by the way. King Menes was the first Egyptian pharaoh who built the first pyramid, and we have statues of him that are made out of white plaster, I think it's called alabaster, with sapphire blue eyes. So you didn't need me to tell you, but it is always a good idea to repeat, that the original builders of all of the giant structures of this planet were built by white people. It's what we do. It's what we do best. Our men are fascinated with huge structures. Now, these Metzamore craftsmen wore mouth filters and gloves while they labored 4,500 years ago, and fashioned their wares of copper, lead, zinc, iron, tin, manganese, and 14 kinds of bronze. So you get a whole different picture than what we've been told, that our people lived in caves or were swinging from the trees 5,000 years ago. You're seeing an actual factory that I'm describing to you with mouth filters and gloves. The smelters also produced an assortment of metallic paints, ceramics, and glass. And then this article says, but what was most interesting was several pairs of tweezers made of steel, taken from layers dating back before the first millennium B.C. That would be 1,000 years B.C. So I guess that 5,000 years ago they were making knives and vases and spearheads, and then 1,000 years ago they had advanced to making tweezers. So that's the history of the white race. We are the builders of the planet, and that is why you have to think twice before you start condemning the Masons or believing that the Masons at the Bohemian Grove are sacrificing live children, because it is not in the history of the white race to sacrifice children. It's in the history of the Edomite race, the brown races that surrounded the ancient Israelites to sacrifice their children. And you probably know just from your own history that there has been a huge amount of sacrifice, human sacrifice, by the Mayans and the Incas. I think tens of thousands of people were sacrificed by having organs taken out of their body while the person is still alive. This is supposed to be a thrill to their God, who likes these kind of things. But our God doesn't, and we know that instinctively, and also because Jesus demonstrated it, that the real God was not the God who took pleasure in torture or harm or cruelty or sacrificing children. But we do see this sacrificing of children going on to this day. Hal Turner has put on his website an article of 5 children that were recently found in Russia whose bodies were burned, and we're talking about September 21st, 2006, so we're talking about less than a month ago. These bodies have been found constantly, by the way, over the last several thousand years. In the Black Forest and other places, their bodies are found, and then the Jews get driven out of these countries, and then when the Jews get in power, they pass laws that say you're not allowed to talk about it. It's called blood libel, and it becomes a crime once the Jews get in control, and they continue to sacrifice our children. And they do it for their high holy days, like Passover, which is one of the reasons I'm so firm in my belief that they sacrificed Jesus and ate him, because it just the timing is too perfect. And they like the most unblemished lamb of all. Of course, you know that's part of it. It has to be the most beautiful blonde child, or it's not as good. So anyway, in Russia, the most recent of these episodes that I've been commenting on for the last 5 years, just recently it was discovered, 5 children were discovered with their burned bodies stuffed into a sewer, and they pulled it out. And then, guess what? The Russian press didn't honestly discuss it. It just let you hang there, and it didn't tell you what other journalists were able to discover, which is that there was a witness to it who says that the bodies were not totally burned, and you could see that the blood had been taken out. That's one of the things the Jews just love to do. It's called kosher killing. And I guess it dates back to a good idea when you're going for a deer and you shoot the deer. I guess you're supposed to kill him, and then you hang him up, and all the blood goes out of his neck. I'm not a hunter, but I think I have heard that. But that's not quite how they do it. The blood, the animal has to be alive for it to work properly to satisfy their hideous God. So that's the deal. That's called kosher killing. You have to cut the throat in half, and then the poor victim has to be held up by its heels until all the blood goes out, and then you get to eat them for Passover or Purim or whatever the holiday is. So this is still going on, and it has always gone on, and it's not anything of our race. We are not the kind of people that believe in this type of God, for one thing, nor do we delight in eating people. We're not the cannibalistic race. So it's very important when you're studying religion to recognize when you hear references to this child sacrifice that you're not learning anything about the God of love that Jesus revealed to us. And it was made clear before Jesus that God, whatever that was, this God of love that is revealed in the Old Testament, but you have to read with discernment to see him as opposed to the God of hate, made it very clear that he did not want the white people, the ancient white Israelites, to mix with the other races. And of course, you and I both know that this is absolutely essential if you want the race to continue. Because being white, we have the best gene, of course, but also the most recessive gene. If there's something about being as evolved as we are, having been in fully human form for 200,000 years, as opposed to some of the other races that have only been around for 10,000 years, we've developed some very fine genetic material. But like taking a weed and turning it into a beautiful flower or an orchid or a dichondra or something, when you mix it with the weed, it's the weed that takes over. So that's where we're at. We have recessive genes. It's not like an equal playing field. If you take beans, for instance, white beans and black beans, I'm talking about vegetables, and you mix them together and you think they know how to do this, florists know how to do this, you come up with half brown beans, and 25% of the beans that you grow in the next generation are black and 25% are white. That's where you have an even playing field without any recessive genes that you have to take into consideration. But with the white race, you don't get an even playing field, so you only get, you get three chances out of eight are that you'll have a black child, one chance out of eight that you'll have a white child, and four chances out of eight that you'll have a brown child. So we are really at a disadvantage in any kind of race mixing situation, which is why the God of our race has made it essential that we are taught not to race mix if we want to survive as a race. And this teaching, this genetic information has been repressed, at least since the Second World War. You know how Hitler's been castigated for talking about eugenics? Well, that's simply the science of genetics in which it is revealed to the students what it means to have recessive genes and how important it is if you want to survive as a race that you marry only members of your race. So, the God of Moses taught the ancient Israelites that they must not marry into other tribes. The neighboring tribes were darker races, and they were sacrificing their babies to please their satanic god. So I thought that I would read to you from Numbers chapter 25 and show you how horrible this god of hate is, that we must not, that we must stand firm against allowing into our country or into our midst anyone who has not accepted the God of love as revealed by Jesus, who many times taught through his little stories that you had to use common sense and kindness when you interpreted the law, because the law could be very cruel. So, remember that the favored sacrifices were the pure white unblemished, so you can be sure that if they were sacrificing babies on these altars all over the hills of Israel, they were going for those little white babies. So it starts here, and Israel at that time abode in Shechem, and the people committed fornication with the daughters of Moab, who called them to their sacrifices. See, the Israelites were living in Shechem, and they were committing fornication with Moabite daughters who were teaching them how to sacrifice. And they ate of the sacrifices and adored the Moabite gods. And Israel was initiated into Baal-Fagor, upon which the Lord, being angry, said to Moses, take all the princes of the people and hang them on gibbets against the sun, that my fury may be turned away from Israel. So this is what we have to understand about the reason that God was so angry, was because Israel was initiated into Baal-Fagor. Now, Baal-Fagor is an obscene idol of the Moabites. And I had a picture for you on my website, but I took it off because it was too ugly. But I can describe it to you. It just showed an innocent baby being prepared to be eaten. And this is what this Baal-Fagor demanded as a sacrifice. Remember, the Bible is written in a very sensitive manner, so it will allow you to see the horrors that it's describing without offending you or scaring you. It's amazingly well written in that respect. So you have to understand what you're being told, or you might not see it. So again, we're going back to, and Israel was initiated into Baal-Fagor, upon which the Lord, being angry, said to Moses, take all the princes of the people and hang them up on gibbets against the sun, that my fury may be turned away from Israel. So you see how God, how angry God was when he saw his beautiful white ancient Israelites partaking in these hideous sacrifices, so angry that he wanted all of the princes, the highest level people, to be killed and hung up on gibbets. Now, actually, I don't see him saying kill them. I had thought it meant kill them, but it only says hang them up on gibbets against the sun. Some better scholar than I can't explain if that meant that these princes should be killed or just being punished. And Moses said to the judges of Israel, let every man kill his neighbors that have been initiated to Baal Fagor. So they were, God was demanding the death of everyone who participated in such a child sacrifice. And now that I think of it, that does make sense, doesn't it? Okay, and behold, one of the children of Israel went in before his brethren to a harlot of Madian in the sight of Moses and of all the children of Israel who were weeping before the door of the tabernacle. Well, of course, everybody was weeping. It was a real catastrophe with all these people being punished with the death penalty for having partaken in these hideous sacrifices. So, behold, one of the children of Israel went in before his brethren to a harlot of Madian in the sight of Moses and of all the children of Israel who were weeping before the door of the tabernacle. And when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose up from the midst of the multitude and, taking a dagger, went in after the Israelite into the brothel house and thrust both of them through together, to wit, the man and the woman, in the genital parts, and the scourge ceased from the children of Israel. So there you see that this commandment that you're not allowed to have sex with anyone outside of your race was caused for capital punishment, and that when this Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he went up and he took a knife and thrust both of them through together, to wit, the man and the woman, in the genital parts, and the scourge ceased from the children of Israel. So this is how serious it is for white people, and not any other people in the world except white people, that it's a capital crime to mix your blood with the blood of a non-white because of the fact of the recessive quality of the gene, and also because you're likely to be tempted into doing what your mate does, which is less, more animalistic and less humanistic things. And there were slain 24,000 men. Now, these numbers are never, you can't believe the numbers in the Bible, but you sure can believe that it was an awful lot of men, so many that they estimated it at 24,000 men. And the Lord said to Moses, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, hath turned away my wrath from the children of Israel, because he moved with my zeal against them, that I myself might not destroy the children of Israel in my zeal. So God was happy because Phinehas went into the man who was fornicating with the harlot and stabbed both of them in the genitals. So now God feels better, and he says, therefore say to him, behold, I give him the peace of my covenant. And the covenant of the priesthood forever shall be both to him and his seed, because he hath been zealous for his God and hath made atonement for the wickedness of the children of Israel. So you see, God saw the wisdom and the zealotry of Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest. Here was a full-blooded champion, wonderful man, who could feel both the rage of God and the love of God at the same time, and knew exactly what God meant, and went right in there and went to business. And the name of the Israelite that was slain with the woman of Madian was Zambri, the son of Salu, a prince of the kindred and tribe of Simeon. So that's just a historical note to forever bring shame upon that man and his family. And the Madianite woman that was slain with him was called Cozbi, the daughter of Sur, a most noble prince among the Madianites. And that's her name, to be forever hated throughout history. So you see that we were talking about noble princes here, because this was a prostitute, and she was the daughter of one of the most noble princes of the Madianites. So you get a little better feel for the depravity of this neighboring tribe that God said we could have nothing to do with. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, let the Madianites find you their enemies and slay you them, because they also have acted like enemies against you, and have guilelessly deceived you by the idol Fogor and Cozbi their sister, a daughter of a prince of Madian, who was slain in the day of the plague for the sacrilege of Fogor. Now, I admit I get lost in those last few words, but I do understand very clearly that this God, who I is so hideous that I couldn't even put a picture up on my website to show you, even though I wanted you to understand, is not a God that we can have anything to do with. And this is a God who rewards cruelty and torture and killing of innocents. And our president is worshiping, obviously, this God, because our president is telling us what a good thing it is to torture. And you probably know that the, is it the U memo or the Wu memo? I can't remember. It's some name like that. One of our big shots in the government wrote a memo and also was caught actually speaking out loud and saying that it's perfectly okay to even use pliers on the testicles of adolescent boys in front of their parents and under certain conditions. The Mr. Yu said, or Mr. Gonzalez, they've both written memos like this saying that we Americans have to use torture if you're going to get information. And we know from the investigation that's going on right now that the judge is demanding that the government bring forth a tape that will show some of these hideous atrocities being committed by our government against the combatants in Iraq. And do you know what our government is telling the judge as an excuse not to give it? Well, Your Honor, the screams of the children who are being tortured are so horrible that if we produce this for you, it will harm the image of the United States. So isn't that wonderful? We have become a country that is worshiping this Baal Fagor person instead of the God of love upon which this country was based and consecrated to. And I think that's something we need to know and we need to discuss. So the reason I wanted you to understand about this worshiping of this satanic demon god by the Midianites as opposed to the God of love, who's revealed to us by Jesus and who was the God of the Israelites, is because I want you to understand why the Masons are so concerned about the Temple of Solomon that's been destroyed a few times in history. This Temple of Solomon was an architectural temple, very large, very beautiful, and very complex. But what's most important about it is that it's built on a two-tier plan where you have the temple where all the white people congregated and ate dinner together and had a good time together and argued cases. And then there's a wall built all around it and some stone steps that go down to another level. And that's where the non-whites were allowed to come and also enjoy the festival. There were two different classes of people. There were the white people and there were the non-white people. The non-white people weren't kept out of the festival. It wasn't forbidden for them to know that God is a God of love and that they could turn away from their wicked ways and learn how to live like white people, but they weren't allowed to be with white people. And for that very good reason, that if they did congregate, the whites with the non-whites, naturally there would be some intermixing, which might, in fact, would lead to interbreeding, which would bring the destruction of the white race. So this Temple of Solomon is important because it's an architect designed to state that the races are supposed to be separate. And what I like about this is that it helps me to argue that St. Paul acted against Christ in his teaching. You may or may not know that St. John said things against St. Paul that indicated that he considered him the Antichrist because St. Paul claimed to be an apostle, and he wasn't an apostle. He never saw Christ personally. He was actually a terrible persecutor of Christians and held the coat of St. Stephen when St. Stephen was being beaten to death. In other words, St. Paul was actually part of the squad of persecutors. He had a position in the Secret Service, or the NKVD, or whatever you call it. And it was his job to persecute Christians and to silence the voice of Christianity, and I think he did a very good job of it, because he's totally screwed up the message of Jesus. And he said that he met Jesus while he was on his way to persecute some more Christians. All of a sudden, Jesus appeared to him, and then he became a Christian, and then he took over the church and taught everybody what Jesus really meant. And what Jesus really meant, according to St. Paul, was that the Temple of Solomon was not supposed to exclude non-whites or non-Israelites. And he proved it by taking one of the members of the darker race with him up on the steps up to the second level. And for this reason, he was captured and put into jail. And then he denied that he had done it. This wonderful, courageous man. And then he went to, in jail, he wrote a treatise as to why it was that he did what he did, even though he had denied doing it, and that God, in fact, wants all of the races to be the same, and that it is not God's intention only to minister to the white race. And that's who St. Paul is. In fact, that is why people love St. Paul so much. And that's why we have such a problem in our religion. And that's why it's so nice to be an Episcopalian and a Mason, because we hate St. Paul, and we don't make any bones about it. And I think it's time to spread that word and to let the Protestants and of the fundamentalists and the Catholics understand that you do have the right to read the Bible with discernment, and you need to take a look at the St. Paul character in the light of what St. John, for instance, has to say about him, which is that he's an Antichrist. He is the Antichrist, in fact, because he took over the church and he perverted its meaning. And one of the things he did, this is the worst part of it, is that he taught Christians that God did not believe in the separation of races. So how can you deal with that? How can you deal with a pope who calls himself a direct descendant of St. Paul, spiritually, that is, and that every little black and brown nigglet and Negro has to be part of God's family? Now, it is true that God created all of these creatures. It is true that God loves all of his creatures. But it is false that we have to intermingle and intermarry. And that's what the ancient Israelites understood, as they proved in their beautiful edifice that they built, the Temple of Solomon, and that's what we have to remember. We have to understand that if we're going to survive as a race, we are going to have to demand the right to be separate. So let's talk about the right to be separate. Why does the white race have a right to be separate? The answer is, of course, because every race has a right to survive. And if you have recessive genes, then you will not survive unless you are kept separate. So now we look at some arguments. The argument that comes out from the Jew at that point is, you're already destroyed as a race. There is no such thing as a pure white person. There is no such thing as a pure white race. Well, that's true, but it's a question of degree. It's true that we have intermarried and that we are no longer like a bunch of champion dogs that all have exactly the same face and the same body and the perfect feathers and it's just the right gloss to our coat. It's true. We're a very mixed up breed, but we can unmix, as William Pierce said. Just because we have mixed doesn't mean we can't unmix. And because we are a race, and anybody can quickly understand, it's totally self-evident that every race has a right to exist, our existence being threatened, we therefore have the right to whatever it takes to assure our existence, and that is separation, as it was taught in the Bible to the ancient Israelites as is revealed by taking a look at the structure of the Temple of Solomon, and as everybody with half a brain knows. I mean, just think of it. If you were hearing about some odd little tribe in South America that was about to go extinct, everybody would be saying, oh, we have to save that race. Every race has a right to exist. But when it comes to the white race, which is one of the three great races, which is well on its way to extinction, everybody celebrates. Well, we have to get rid of this evil race because they gave chickenpox to the Indians, or they had slaves, or Hitler killed 6 million in ovens. So your race is different. Your race has to die. Every other race can live. And this is where we have to argue intelligently and logically until we just break through the barrier of the brainwashing, which is so intense and has been going on since at least the time of Hitler. Actually, I think it may have been going on since the time of St. Paul, because he makes it very clear that he thinks the races should be intermingled, and proved it by taking a non-white up into the white area in the Temple of Solomon and got arrested for it. Guess how I learned all this stuff about St. Paul? I went to church last Sunday, and I was so upset because I love my church. It's the Presbyterian Church, and Presbyterians are by nature very racist. At my church, we actually come to church once a year with our family tartan, the family plaid, and show off what wonderful white people we are. But alas and alack, the Presbyterian Church has been taken over by the communists. And after the preacher gave us the story about St. Paul, he of course taught it entirely differently from the way I taught it. He said that St. Paul did the right thing to take the non-white up into the inner sanctum where only white people were supposed to be. And we should all be like St. Paul, and we should all bring as many blacks and browns as we can into the church. And then he showed a bunch of walls and talked about walls being bad, including the Mexican border. And I'm on the PowerPoint, so I'm showing this big picture of the Mexican border with a wall, a fence built there. And the preacher is saying, walls are bad. We are all going to pray now that God will break down the walls that come between us and him. But let me assure you, he had been talking about the Mexican wall, and that's really what these people were being asked to pray about. So all of the brainwashed Presbyterians all say, oh God, please don't let that Mexican wall go up, because I know God, the preacher has told us that you hate walls, and he showed us the Berlin Wall, and he showed us that the Wall of China didn't do any good, and Hadrian's Wall, we can't have that wall down on Mexico. Oh, God, no, please, please, hear our prayer. Hear the prayer of the people, and bring communism to our land. And that upset me so much that I decided to make an entire show of what's going on in the Presbyterian Church. And I think this is very sad, because the Presbyterian Church is one of the churches that spend a lot of time studying Mel Gibson's Passion of Christ. We had a lot of discussions about it, and some people were even strong enough to get right up and say something like, well, I think that the Jews are wrong on this one, and that's why I joined the church. But they get their weekly messages from somebody up above the priest or the preacher, I don't know what they call him, that in that church. But pastor, I think, he gets his lessons handed to him from some higher authority. And so last Sunday, the message was no to the Mexican wall. Everybody pray that we won't have a wall down on our Mexican border. And I just was quite unhappy to hear that. And I wanted to report it to my white brethren. So, getting back to the Masons, I'm surprised that I'm not getting some calls arguing with me that the Masons are child molesting, sacrilegious beasts. The number is 201-484-7809, and I have just asserted that the Masons are innocent of what's going on in this country. And I'm not getting any arguments. But do you notice how many of the so-called 9/11 truth movement keeps blaming everything on the Masons? Well, why do you think that might be? It's because after having attacked our country, the Jews have put into place truth tellers, unquote, who are blaming it on the Masons. What could be more perfect? Attack the country, put your harness around the country's military, make it exhaust itself against your other enemy, and then blame the whole thing on the innocent people in the country that you attacked. You can't go wrong. And what's happening to the dollar? I wonder what the price of gold is today. I've been noticing it's been going up pretty fast. I think it's gone up about $30 in 3 days. Let's see. Oh, it went down a little bit. You can still run and get some tomorrow. It went down from 625 to 623. But it was at 580, I think, last month. So it's going up pretty fast. And you all know about the Feds and how the Jews got in control of the Federal Reserve and that we're paying interest on money that's being printed for no other reason than it's being printed. And that our national debt is, what is it, $14 trillion or $41 trillion? And that 90% of our tax dollar goes to paying the interest on these loans, which we shouldn't even be paying interest on because we could get our own printing press and do it just as well. But that's just one of the tricks that we have to face all the time. So what does this come down to in daily life? It comes down to the fact that I think we need to start becoming calm and serene about it. I am. I'm quite convinced to a moral certitude that the white race has been targeted for extermination. I'm quite convinced that Hitler was a gentleman and that the German people have been maligned with blood libel like we've never, ever dreamed of laying on the heads of the Jews. Blood libel, you know, is a crime if you say that the Jews are sacrificing your children just because you found their body in the Black Forest and all the blood was drained out and the child appeared to have been eaten. That's blood libel. But if there's no evidence whatsoever of gas chambers, well, it's blood libel, and we will punish you if you say that against the Jews. I mean, if you don't, what am I trying to say? It's not blood libel to say the same thing against the innocent German people. So there again, it's an unfair thing where we aren't allowed to tell the truth about the cruel things that are done to us. But if we dare to defend ourselves against cruelties that we didn't commit, then we're guilty. And I'm quite convinced of that. I'm also quite convinced that most of the people in my town know this because we have white people here and Armenians. And remember, the Armenians were the victims of a Holocaust perpetrated on them by a guy named Ataturk, where a million and a half Armenians were killed. And Ataturk was a direct descendant of this guy who invented Frankism. His name will come to me. Zvi somebody or other. So the Armenians know very well what's going on with the Jews. And the Lebanese, we have Lebanese here. They certainly know what's going on. So isn't it funny that even in Glendale, with all of these intelligent people who are in the know, we still almost never talk about it? And so what I think it's time to do is to exercise that social grace of going among the people and just talking and trying to learn how to have the courage to say in normal conversation that we shouldn't be fighting this war because it only serves the Jew, and that the Jews are wrong to make it illegal in 9 European countries to question the historical event known as the Holocaust, and just try to get these conversations going. But I'll tell you, it's very hard to do because these people, while they know very well what the truth is, they also know how dangerous it is to speak. And I think that's what we need to do, and that's why I do this program, because I want to develop the courage to speak about these things in a comfortable way. Now, when this thing first hit us on 9/11 and we saw ourselves going to war in Iraq, a lot of us woke up at that moment, didn't we? Because we knew that Iraq didn't have anything to do with 9/11. Even the widest stretch of imagination could not bring us into conflict with Iraq over 9/11 because our own government had said it was Afghanistan. So everybody sort of started getting curious when we went to war in Iraq, and I noticed that I was completely unable to communicate about it because I was so enraged to see my country going to war unnecessarily, and it was so obviously unnecessarily. I became very angry and very frightened and very suspicious, and I wasn't able to comfortably talk to my fellow human being here in Glendale about the situation because it was so weird. It was such a catastrophe. What had happened to my government? The only thing I could remember ever having been hit with a catastrophe like that was the JFK assassination, when I had a very similar reaction. After the JFK assassination, I thought, I was 21 at the time, and I thought, well, you know, this might be a conspiracy, and I'll know if it's a conspiracy or not by how they treat Oswald. Because Oswald is a very important witness. If he's the guy that did it, we need a trial. And if anything happens to Oswald, I'm going to know there's some hanky-panky going on. And so then when I saw Oswald being shot by Ruby, I thought, holy cow, I was smarter than I wished I was. Something really is wrong. And the interesting thing is, I couldn't talk about it. I couldn't get anyone to agree with me. There was something too frightening about it for me to talk about. I could be one of those, oh, I did read Mark Lane's book that said that it was a conspiracy, and I read it, and I liked it very much. And I noticed that Dorothy Kilgallen, who was here in Los Angeles, was every week she was using her column to write the minutes of the Warren Commission. And I thought, gee, that woman is, that is bravery, isn't it? I mean, I'd never seen such a threat to my peace of mind as I did when I saw Kennedy being assassinated. So I was thinking differently. I was thinking as a grown-up woman, not as a child anymore. And I was saying, this woman, this is courage, what this woman is doing. And then we all found out that Dorothy Kilgallen was found dead in her apartment. And I thought, and that's what they do to courageous women and men. And this is terrible. There's something terribly wrong here. The point I'm trying to make is that I was never comfortable talking about it. Now, part of that was not my fault, because if you'll remember back to the Kennedy assassination, which was 1963, there was this huge propaganda coming out of all of the news media and the magazines about conspiracy theorists, and that the worst thing you could be was a conspiracy theorist. And it was like being a paranoiac, that you needed to be put outside the city gates or locked up or something. Anybody who was a conspiracy theorist, oh my God, that was the worst thing you could be. So I'm sure that had its effect on me. But I think also it was the fact that everybody else was in shock, and nobody had the courage, even me, and I'm kind of a sassy person, to bring up the subject and say, ye God, somebody has taken over our government and has killed our favorite president for nothing, except that he's good looking. We really need to talk about this. What I'm saying was, there was not a lot of discussion after the assassination of JFK. In fact, pretty much we all went along and acted like we accepted what the government told us, because we were really afraid of being outcasted by being considered paranoid and conspiracy theorists. And then you became... There seemed like there were two people in the United States. As the time went on and the decades went on, you either believed in the one lone assassin theory or you didn't. And you were kind of at odds. There were two teams that were always kind of at odds. And I was always uncomfortable about the whole issue of the assassination of JFK until 9/11. And when 9/11 happened, I recalled what I went through when JFK died, and I thought that I was going through the same type of shock. Actually, it wasn't 9/11. It was when we went into war with Iraq, because at first I believed what the government said. Okay, Arabs with box cutters killed us attacked us because they hate our freedoms. All right, that's good to know. We have an enemy. We all have to gear up and go and fight the enemy. And I was gung-ho on the Afghanistan war until I found out that we weren't doing anything of value there. You know, it didn't seem like we were doing anything. But I thought it was okay. You get attacked, you fight back. That's what you're supposed to do. But when we went into a war against Iraq, that's when I felt that same feeling I felt when JFK was assassinated, that we had been duped, that our country, our nation, had been assassinated, that the very concept of America had been attacked by an enemy outside. Yes, there was infiltration. There had to be infiltration, because obviously there were many people on the inside who were helping the people on the outside to make this horrible attack on our country go so smoothly. And there was a lot of influence with the press. And so you saw that the press was involved. And you had two points in time now. I did. Anyone who lived at the time of the Kennedy assassination had two points in time. The Kennedy assassination and the murder of Oswald, because I didn't wake up to the fact that it was an assassination by nefarious forces until Oswald was killed by Jack Ruby. So as soon as we saw Jack Ruby killing Oswald, we had that point in time, and then we had the war against Iraq taking place after the attack on the World Trade Center. Two points in time, two things, two events that you could look at and analyze for similarities. And we saw, a lot of us, the older people my age, saw it's the same people. It's the same modus operandi. It's the same thing. And so then we could start analyzing both of the events using the same measuring instruments. And what do you suppose we found? Well, of course, what we found was Jews. We found dirty, stinking, hook-nosed, circumcised, smelly, filthy, short, squat, ugly Jews. The kind of Jews we were never allowed to say were ugly, short, stocky, fat, greasy, big nose, circumcised, because it wasn't nice to say bad things about Jews any more than you'd make fun of Negroes. You could never say a bad thing about a Jew because they were so obviously horrible. And it would hurt their feelings if you spoke about them in an honest way. And Lord knows we want to be nice. But everything started to fall into place for me and for many, many people. And then we found Mordecai Vanunu. Mordecai Vanunu was a member of the Israeli physicist Department of Physics. He was a nuclear physicist that worked on Israel's nukes. And he came out about 20 years ago and blew the whistle on Israel's nukes, because Israel wasn't supposed to have any nukes, much less 400 to 600 nukes. And Mordecai Vanunu came out 20 years ago and said, Kennedy was killed by Jews because he was coming to take away Israel's nukes, and I, Mordecai Vanunu, a nuclear physicist in Israel, am here throwing my life into the fan because I think it's worth doing just to alert you to the fact that the Jews have nukes, because they're not supposed to have nukes. And then he got whisked away by Israel and put in solitary confinement for 18 years for having blown the whistle on the nukes, which was a crime against Israel's national security. And he came out of jail about a year ago, and he said, and not only that, But they did 9/11 too. That is how brave this man was. And a lot of us were listening to more, you know, listening for, all of our ears were all pricked up for any news to help us put together the JFK assassination and the WTC thing on 9/11. And here's Mordecai Vanunu coming right out and just laying it on the line. This is what happened. The Mossad has infiltrated your government and has gotten into positions of sensitivity and are pulling your country down. And that's what's really happening. And once you realize it, it's not so hard to accept. I mean, why? This, we are not the first country that's been invaded by an enemy. And I don't have any particular hatred for the Jews, except the natural hatred I would feel toward an enemy. But the Jews are not doing anything wrong. They're just attacking us. They're not disloyal to Israel. They're loyal to Israel. We are the ones who are not fighting back. That's where the problem is. I think we're suffering from a huge national guilt because we're allowing the enemy to come in, infiltrate us, attack us, put their harness around our military, waste our treasury, send us to war against their enemy, and bankrupt us. And we're just sitting here saying, oh, well, you can't say anything bad about a Jew, because God knows how they've suffered. And it's not their fault that they're so short and fat and have such big noses. This is what our guilt is. This is our national guilt. This is what the white man is suffering from. Not the guilt of the gas chambers, which he never even had built. We didn't build any gas chambers. And we didn't give any blankets full of smallpox to Indians either on purpose. And slavery was the state of the art in the day, and we had the best situation any slaves ever had was what they had when they left their horrible place in Africa and went to live in the little houses that were built for them by the plantation owners and agriculture. So it is not about our guilt, ladies and gentlemen, that we have to start expunging is our inability to stand up to the Jew and say, nice try, we see that you what you did, and we are going to fight back. The best way to fight back is open your mouth and talk. We are the intelligentsia, and we can solve the problem.
Listening to the